Since the dawn of civilization, spies of every nation and culture have worked to infiltrate their adversaries and glean the information that will give their side the advantage. The stakes are sky high, the strategies varied and imaginative, and the ultimate sign of success is that no one ever even knew you were there. In each episode, we will explore the moral and ethical gray zones of espionage, where treachery and betrayal go hand in hand with cunning and courage. This is the Spycraft 101 podcast. Welcome to your clandestine classroom. This is episode number 148 of the Spycraft 101 podcast. Today, I'm joined by Ronald Drapke. Ron earned his bachelor's degree from Duke University and his master's from UC Berkeley. Since then, he's worked in the tech industry, first with Intel Corporation and later as an entrepreneur and investor. He's also written peer-reviewed articles on espionage history in Japan. I invited Ron onto the podcast today to discuss his first book, published earlier this year, titled Beverly Hills Spy, the double agent war hero who helped Japan attack Pearl Harbor. It's the story of Frederick Rutland, a veteran pilot and aviation pioneer who left the British Royal Navy to work with the fledgling Japanese aviation industry in the 1920s. Rutland's contributions over the coming years helped them leap forward and better prepare for their coming war with their greatest adversary, the United States Navy fleet based at Pearl Harbor. By the way, if you're looking for a way to get friends and family as interested in history as you are, or if you want to learn something new and unexpected every month, then make sure to check out History by Mail. Every month, History by Mail will send you reproductions of famous and influential historical documents from American history. Accompanying the documents themselves are articles which put them in the context of their times and help you understand the impact they had on the course of American life. The topics are widely varied, so you're always learning something new across themes that include historic inventions, American wars, and foreign diplomatic relations. I'm really enjoying my own subscription because it's opened my eyes to historic events I knew nothing about. For instance, one of the first packages I received contained a reproduction letter from Annie Oakley to President William McKinley, offering her services as a sharpshooter during the Spanish-American War of 1898. Who knew? Not me. You can subscribe for yourself or gift a subscription at historybymail.com for as little as $6.50 a month. Just click the link in the show notes of this episode and use the discount code Justin10 for a permanent 10% off your subscription. Ron, thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Justin.
You know, I've touched on Japanese espionage leading up to Pearl Harbor before a little bit, but I had no idea until I read your book how extensive it was. And I definitely did not realize that a British pilot had such a major role to play in everything that came later.
Yeah, absolutely. Wrote this book because I found just a crazy, recently declassified story of the Japanese espionage on the West Coast and around Pearl Harbor before World War II. And I wrote the book because it just wasn't out there. You know, I had a small personal connection to the story. Yeah, my father had worked for U.S. counterintelligence. It's currently under the FBI, but at the time it was under the U.S. Army. And I'd been looking into what he had done when he was in counterespionage. And I sort of uncovered, when I talked to the FBI, some of these new documents they had just recently declassified. I was like, geez, this is you know, a story. It's got to get out there. That's kind of the genesis of the book there.
That's fantastic. I love the fact that so many people, yourself included, have just found one little thing and it kind of opens this whole door up to a huge amount of research. And then ultimately the readers and the listeners really benefit that from that because they're learning something that not only have they never heard, but almost no one anywhere has ever heard of before. And this really was an eye-opening story to me because I just had not imagined that this would have happened or could have happened, honestly, but I'm very glad that I was able to read it from you. So can you tell us a little bit about who was Frederick Rutland, like his early life, that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Yeah. So Rutland was probably the most famous naval aviator of World War I. He was most famous for the Battle of Jutland, was the largest surface naval battle in history. Hmm. He was the pilot they chose for the first ever carrier combat mission. So, you know, the British and the German navies were clashing, and the British actually had one aircraft, which he was the pilot of, and he flew over the German fleet, basically told the British fleet where the Germans were. And that was it. That was the extent of the first carrier combat mission. But everyone could see, you know, it was a very small, you know, 80 horsepower sticks and string kind of plane. But you could see, everyone could see where this was going. these planes were going to get larger and stronger and get you know, weapons. We saw what happened about a little over 20 years later at Pearl Harbor.
Man, that's absolutely amazing that he was truly the first, not just an early adopter or anything like that, but truly the first guy to take off and land from a vessel mm-hmm. at sea. And would you say that his role was decisive in that battle, or was it just the first time that had been attempted and, you know, he didn't crash upon return or something?
Yeah. You know, the British didn't really, it was a little hard for them to figure out a little, you know, they're, what do we radio where? So it didn't work out that well for the British, but everyone could see what was happening, right? The potential there.
I see. I see. And did he continue to stay at the forefront of this new, I don't know if I'd go so far as to call it technology, but this new strategy, this new way of warfare anyway, or was he kind of sidelined after that?
Hugh did a lot of very pioneering things for the Royal Navy Air Service. Specifically, he became the squadron leader of their first carrier strike group on the HMS Furious. And he also did some other things, like he pioneered the first planes taking off of battleship turrets and cruiser turrets, the scout planes on those ships. This was significant because those ships were actually moving, you know. So back at Jutland, his ship had stopped for him to take off.
Oh, I see. So I didn't even realize that. So they could take off in the early days from just the flat top of the large gun turret?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. He was able to,
wow.
You know, he pulled out his string and his chalk and he was measuring it. It was, you know, pretty exciting stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, very rudimentary, I'm sure, but that's how everything starts.
Yeah. A lot of bravery involved as well. It's like bravery and smarts, both. You need both of those things. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly.
But this, you know, the kind of crazy thing about this fellow, Rutland, was that he was quite different in background from all the other British pilots. And this was partly one of the reasons for his success. So he was not an aristocratic upper-class Englishman, right? He was one of the poorest of the poor. You know, his dad was an itinerant laborer who grew up over by a naval base in the south of England. And he sort of grew up watching the British Navy ships come in and out. And it was such a poor family that, well, you know, he joined the Royal Navy when he was 14, lying about his age. And at the time, he was 5'3". And the assumption is he was just that small because he just didn't have enough food growing up, right? Mm. But he came in really bright with a chip on his shoulder. You know, the other Royal Navy pilots in World War One, they were typically, you know, you get a 22-year-old graduate of the Naval Academy or of Oxford or Cambridge, right? And he had actually been in the Navy as an enlisted man for about 10 years before getting promoted. And so a lot of the early aviation technology was really engineering. You know, the pilots were fixing these things themselves. They were modifying themselves, right? And his time as a, you know, torpedo operator and as a diver and basically every position on a ship really helped him drive the innovation forward of the new technology.
Right. On top of his like aviation accomplishments, he was just extremely tech savvy, wasn't he? I think he patented some improvements to the radio or something like that. Do I recall that?
Yeah, correctly? You do. Yeah, it was the really radios were shorting out and he figured out that it was the moisture in the land radios were shorting out over water. Right.
Mm, okay.
Of course, right? Right, of course. But he actually went in and did the fix and updated all the radios. And, you know, the admirals were like, wow, an recently enlisted man, you know, junior lieutenant, pilot, has just upgraded all the radios in the entire fleet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's going to come to play later when you're talking about espionage, because, you know, a lot of espionage is industrial. How do you find the best technology?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So he doesn't have the... I guess the ancestral pedigree that a lot of Royal Navy officers have, but he's clearly very, very capable in this new field where there's probably hardly anybody that can do what he do. So why is it that he ended up leaving the Royal Navy rather than, you know, making it all the way to admiral or commander of a carrier, you know, strike group or something like that?
Yeah, there was a few reasons, but, you know, his background did not help him, right? He was a lower class guy and these aristocrats didn't typically like that. He was older. He was a little coarse. He was, you know, plain spoken. It was kind of what you'd expect, right? As a very, very motivated mm-hmm. fella who pulled himself up from his bootstraps, right? He also did some other things, like he was doing some wife swapping with one of the other officers. You know, that was just not done. You know.
Okay. Yeah. You reminded me that I'd forgotten about that briefly, but yeah, that will have an effect on your reputation.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I see. So did he kind of leave in disgrace or anything like that? Or did he just ultimately decide that his place was elsewhere?
It was definitely not in disgrace. You know, they told him, look, you're going to have a job with the new Royal Air Force. You're just not going to get promoted. You've got the skills. Hmm. We're trying to design new carriers. You know how to do that. But you're not going to get promoted. And he gets really hot under the collar about this. He thinks he's the best. Arguably he is. Mm-hmm. But that's not the only way to get ahead in the world. And he starts looking around for other options. And the Japanese Navy and the Royal Navy were allies at this time. And Japanese observers had been, you know, with the Royal Navy at the Battle of Jutland, etc. The Japanese Navy's, they started out their own carrier program, and they've got an office in Westminster in London. And he just walks in there one day looking for a job. You know, he walks in and he says, you know, I'd like to talk with you. You know, my name is Rutland. And the Japanese officers there on duty said, we know exactly who you are. We'd like to talk to you.
Yeah, I can imagine they would. This was like manna from heaven to them, wasn't it? Like the one guy they would want above all others just walked in on his own.
Just walks right in the office, yeah.
So did they, I mean, was there like a lot of negotiation or legal hurdles or anything like that? Or were they just like, we'll give you whatever you want and we need your knowledge?
Yeah, the hurdles were around, the British were not happy about him taking some job. And we found some Japanese documents showing what the Japanese had done. He went to work for the Japanese Navy, but that's not what they told the British. They told the British that he was going to be an advisor to Mitsubishi Company, a private company. Hmm. The British still didn't like that, but legally they were able to get by it that way. Yeah.
I've got you. So it sounds to me like the implication a little bit is they already had their eye on Rutland at that point. The British government, were they still keeping tabs on him after he left service?
Yeah, they were. They put a file together because this whole thing with the Japanese, they knew about it because they were breaking Japanese codes, right? As you know, Justin, you can't let people know you've broken their codes. Otherwise, they change their codes, right? So they threw that in a file, and it just didn't seem, you know, there were other Britons that were taking jobs over there. He had unusual ability, but, you know, they let it go.
I see. It was just not worth the hassle of potentially showing their hand, so to speak, with the codes in. But it does sound like they kind of were aware of the potential issues here. It was just a question of importance, really.
Yeah.
So how did he contribute at that point to Japanese aviation industry or military air power?
Yeah. So what they did is normally at that point, the Americans and Brits were all living in this kind of foreign settlement in Yokohama. But what they did is they set him up, you know, down south by the Japanese naval base in Yokosuka, this nice beach resort. Basically, as they were redesigning their new carriers, you know, updating the new planes, the head Japanese pilots, they were coming by his office, you know, in his house in their plainclothes a couple days a week. You know, he's going out to their factories and advising them. And basically, within a couple of years there, the Japanese carrier strike force was, you know, sort of, you know, basically there, right?
Hmm. Yeah. So this was a major priority for the Japanese as well. I mean, they were undergoing a huge modernization effort, like kind of across all aspects of their economy and military and everything at that time, weren't they?
Yeah. Yep, exactly. And in particular, you know, the Navy was a big deal for them as a, you know, island nation. They had built their first carrier themselves. At the beginning, they were basically flying British surplus Sopwith planes and such. Mm-hmm. They hired a couple of the British pilots and such, but you know, pretty soon they were able to make it all Japanese. You know, Mitsubishi was making their own planes. Their pilots were getting better and better. A fellow named Yamamoto, who had come back from the U.S., was helping train up the air group, and they were kind of good to go, at least at the early stage there.
Mm-hmm. Did Rutland at this point at all, or I should say during this period in his life, did he have, to your knowledge, any kind of second thoughts or like, hey, maybe I should not be building up a foreign power? Or was this, you know, exactly what he had hoped for after leaving the Royal Navy?
It's a great question, Justin. And I'm going to give you my opinion because, you know, obviously I don't know what was in his head, but I think it was a slippery slope. He didn't think that it would do any harm. You know, Britain and Japan were allies. Mm-hmm. World War II was very far away. At this time, you know, Japan had been on the Allied side in World War I, of course, helping the British against the Germans.
Oh, okay.
I didn't see a hint of any remorse there at that point.
Okay, I've got you. And not only that, but he was extraordinarily well paid, as I understand it, for his assistance during that time.
Yeah, you should see the houses he was living in Yokohama and later in Beverly Hills. Wow, you know.
Yeah, I bet. So since you mentioned Beverly Hills, and of course, that's the title of the book, what is it that then brought him to America?
You know, early in World War I, the British were definitely the best at airplane technology, right? Aircraft carriers. At some point, the U.S., we started getting better and better as well. And the Japanese wanted to keep tabs on what the Americans were doing around the Navy and, you know, aircraft and such. You know, there are a bunch of the Japanese guys are sitting around saying, we need a source on the West Coast. You know, they hadn't done much espionage yet. They tried a little bit, which, you know, I can get into, but, you know, they really needed someone who could sort of fit in with the locals. And they were like, we need someone like Rutland. And they were like, well, what, you know, what's he doing these days? And he had gone back to London and they said, let's talk to him, see if he'll help us. they approach him again. He's kind of bored back in England. He'd been working for his brother-in-law's company, you know, doing some sales. Not the most exciting life in the world. Mm-hmm. They say to him, you know, we'd like you to work for us again. And he's very excited by that. And then they say, we'd like you to move to Hollywood, Los Angeles, Beverly Hills. And that's a shocker for him. But, you know, they explain the logic about it. You'll fit in well there. Hollywood's got a lot of British movie stars at the time. Good British colony, and you can help us with the airplanes and let us know what's going on, and it'll be great. Mm-hmm. And he takes them up on it.
So I have to assume that at this point, he's really under no illusions about what he's doing, because this is so different than training aviators or something like that. Do you think that he also kind of jumped into this without any reservations, or was this a little bit like, well, you know, this is quite a bit different?
I don't sense that he had any reservations. I think kind of a legend in his own mind, I would say. Mm-hmm. You know, there was, you know, the thought, you know, back in 1932 that there'd be a major war between the U.S. and Japan. To be fair, you know, World War II was pretty far away. Mm-hmm. Hitler wasn't even in power yet. The thought back then was, why would a Japanese ever get into a fight with the U.S.? They could never win, right?
Right.
That was
right.
The thought. Yeah.
I see. Yeah, I guess he can justify, well, and almost anyone can justify anything in their own mind if the reward is great enough and they're pulled to do it. So understandable, but it's just such an unexpected story to me, honestly, that, you know, that one of the top Japanese spies in America was a British Royal Navy aviator. I'm just still having a hard time wrapping my mind around it, even though it clearly happened just as you're describing.
Yeah.
So he just settled his family in there. I mean, he was living the high life in Beverly Hills and rubbing shoulders with famous people, that sort of thing.
Yep, exactly. He was, his house, you know, it's up on Zillow, right? And I looked it up. It's $14 million right now.
Oh my gosh.
Up in the hills. It's, you can see Westwood, you can see UCLA, you can see the beach. It's a double lot up there, way up, you know, where all the movie stars live. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he quickly fits himself in with the British actors at the time. So, you know, a lot of the early actors in Hollywood were actually British, you know, silent movies, right? So nobody knew they had British accents, but Charlie Chaplin to Boris Karloff and Nigel Bruce, a lot of these folks were British, and they had a private club where he was able to ingratiate himself.
Mm, man, he is truly living the life. Like, it's all working out so well for him, all of this so far, at least.
Yeah. So far, so good, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Did he have to engage during this time period in any of the like typical spy tradecraft, like sending coded messages, meeting with people, you know, at night, that sort of thing?
The Japanese were going back and forth on what his role should be. Some of them were saying he should be a sleeper. Mm-hmm. Some of them were saying, look, when a war starts, we're going to be gone. There won't be any more Japanese embassy or anything like that. Who could be better than a British person? No one would suspect it, right? So we should keep him quiet. Others were like, look, we're paying this guy a lot of money. and those folks eventually went out. And so he's doing the traditional espionage stuff. And, you know, secret messages, you know, they go out. The Japanese ship captains come into town, the merchant ships come into the harbor. You know, he can just get his file of what he's picked out. And he just goes to the ship captain, passes the file over. No one's going to intercept that, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that he was doing, and some of the other Japanese agents were doing, is they set up some operations in Mexico right over the border. You could just like take secrets over the border. There was a house of ill repute, a short walk from San Diego, right?
Oh, okay, yeah.
They could meet there, and then a couple of Japanese guys running, you know, this bar and house of ill repute could take the information and send to the right people.
My gosh. Straight out of a noir film is what it sounds like to me, meeting in the brothel on the other side of the border.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, Justin, this is one thing I'm excited about, that the fellow who ran that brothel, his file has been declassified, and I'm going to get it in about a few weeks here.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. Yeah. Did a FOIA request or something like that?
Yeah. 3 years ago, and it came back a couple weeks ago, you know, saying, okay, yeah, there's no reason this can't be declassified. If you want it, here's how you pay your money. And
Fantastic. Yeah. I truly hate what a long game it is to really find out about things that happened back then. Like, what, you know, what from 1937 could possibly hurt anyone to declassify at this point? It's hard to imagine, but it's still such a long, involved process for all of my authors and researchers and everybody, even people telling their own stories. Of course, they, you know, sometimes have to wait years to talk about some aspect of their lives.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny because, yeah, the people that work there are great, right? They're super helpful. I think what happens is usually, you know, the same people or the same researchers are looking into, you know, military pensions, like, oh, this person, you actually work for them, that gets prioritized.
Oh, I see. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I haven't really done that myself, so I don't have much of an experience with it, but that's interesting that you'd have to be kind of competing against so many, you know, requests of varying priorities. I guess that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Before we go on, I want to tell you all about a new podcast from Tenderfoot TV called To Die For. Imagine you were a fly on the wall at a dinner between the Mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where this unprecedented podcast begins. Brought to you by the makers of the hit podcast To Live and Die in L.A., To Die For marks the first time a Russian-trained honey trap has told her story from beginning to end. Taught to seduce men for their secrets, and sometimes their lives, Alia Rosa was trained to believe that her body no longer belonged to her. It belonged to the state. She was meticulously trained to be the perfect weapon, able to seduce her targets into compromising situations that have ended careers, and sometimes lives. From Tenderfoot TV, the studio that brought you Up and Vanished, and To Live and Die in L.A., make sure you check out To Die For, available beginning on March 26th, wherever you get your podcasts. So, while he's engaged in all of this, is the FBI or British intelligence or anybody starting to kind of home in on him, or is everyone still oblivious to the British spy in their midst?
The British are well aware of what he's doing because they're still reading the Japanese coded messages, mm-hmm. right? Which are going back and forth between their folks in London and Tokyo. And they're not telling anyone, right? The last thing the British wanted to do, intelligence wanted to do, was to cooperate with U.S. intelligence at that point, right?
Oh, my gosh.
You can play that forward, right? In the future, right?
Yeah.
The Japanese, they do have a few spies out there before Bretland gets there, their own naval officers. One in particular gets drunk and crashes his car and dies, and the LAPD find him, you know, with his briefcase full of stolen naval information.
Yeah. I was stunned by that. Yeah, there's some very clumsy moves there on their part in a couple of situations.
Yeah. Not the most professional things in the world, right?
Right.
My dad used to talk about how, like, you know, the worst part about being in intelligence is he wasn't able to drink ever, you know?
Yeah, that does open the door to a lot of problems for many people in the US, no doubt. My gosh. Yeah, so the Brits are aware that this guy is helping Japanese. Japanese really don't have any realistic way of targeting British Navy in the Atlantic or any British holdings, but most definitely, you know, the U.S. is vulnerable, as we see later on with hindsight, of course. So that's a cold-blooded decision, you know, in my opinion. I totally understand wanting to protect that, you know, signals intelligence that they've got, but it's very unfortunate that they would choose not to pass along that information in some form, or even, you know, lie about where it came from or something like that.
Yeah, for sure. And it got more and more embarrassing. See, fast forward, getting ahead of ourselves here, you know, 7-8 years later. The British are like, we got to tell the Americans about this guy now.
Right. This guy they've known about for 20 years.
Yeah. Who's been operating on U.S. soil, you know, with the movie stars for, you know, the last 7 years. And mm-hmm. By the way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who, I'm trying to think, it was Charles de Gaulle at one point. I think he said something like, nations don't have friends, they only have interests or something. So I might be misquoting him there. I might even be misappropriating it from somebody else, but it makes sense that, you know, you think you have a strong alliance with somebody, but they're always going to act in what they think is their best interest at that time, unfortunately.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm.
So as things got closer to what we now know was, you know, war with the United States, did he see what was on the horizon? And I mean, how did he react knowing that he was essentially, you know, living in a country that was being targeted by his employer?
Yeah, he does wake up at some point. The key time was, you know, he goes back to Japan about once a year, roughly, just to report out. If you're talking about tactics or designs of aircraft, you know, you really need to be in person to get over, you know, to go that stuff. Right?
Okay.
And usually he's got two families, right? He's got his wife and kids in LA. And he's got his ex-wife and kids who are back in London. And he's got an 18-year-old daughter named Barbara who graduates high school back in London. And, you know, she's feeling a little strange for him. You know, he took off, right, with a new woman, moved mm-hmm. to a different country. And he invites her out to L.A. and she, you know, to stay with him and, you know, just kind of fix things up, right? Takes her to the parties. She gets to meet some movie stars. The newspapers in L.A. call her the, you know, dark-haired British beauty, right? So she's having a great old time. And he says, you know, I'm going to Japan. Why don't you come with me, right? Go to Japan, see the sights. They can stop in Hawaii on the way back. And so I think he sells Japan a little less than he sells the trip to Hawaii on the way back. You can guess why he's going to Hawaii, right?
Yeah.
Check out Pearl Harbor, right?
Right.
But basically, he gets over to Japan, and he's as they're there and they're about to start doing their sightseeing, Germany invades Poland and, you know, World War II starts in Europe. Until then, Japan had been, it's always a little militaristic, but at this point, he's just looking around and it's just like war is coming, right? There's war in Europe. his country, Britain's involved. He can't really leave the hotel without guard because, you know, people might take a swing at him or something. You know, he'd promise his daughter, you know, some fun tourism. She doesn't get that, right? At that point, you know, when he comes back, they stop by, you know, like I say, Pearl Harbor. His daughter goes to the beach and is soaking up the sun while he's taking pictures of Pearl Harbor. But when he goes by, he's like, this really could, there actually might be a shooting war between the U.S. and Japan. If so, I'd be on the wrong side. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you know, the FBI is still not really paying any attention to him, but he goes to U.S. Naval Intelligence and offers to become a double agent at that point.
Wow. So he just cold approached U.S. Navy Intelligence at that point and said, I have something for you. I mean, he had no previous relationship with him or anything. Did they even know who he was at that point?
I don't exactly know, but I assume that they knew about him just because he was such a famous guy.
Yeah, true. He's a pioneer like we've been talking about over and over again. So,
yeah.
I mean, I have to assume that this, once again, the exact person that they would want above all others just walked in and offered his help, just like he had with the Japanese 20 years before. So how does that work out? Does that, I mean, do they fully exploit that relationship or do they not take him seriously or what?
Yeah, this is where, again, we're seeing that the U.S. intelligence agency is not working well together. The Navy took this really seriously, right? If you're naval intelligence, what's your job? Well, it's to protect the U.S. Navy, right? Mm-hmm. And he's coming in asset for the, you know, the biggest adversary or supposed adversary, the U.S. Navy. You know, he's basically saying, look, there's going to be a shooting war between the U.S. and Japan. The Japanese always strike first. They always have in the prior wars, right? Mm-hmm. I know these guys, you know, he's like, I've been working them for 20 years. You know, the admirals, Shimada, Yamamoto, you know, these guys, I've been to their houses. They pay me and you want me telling you what's going on here. And it's a pretty compelling case, right? Mm-hmm. By the way, he's happy to take their money, right?
Yeah. Is he asking for money from U.S. Naval Intelligence at that point, or is he just going to continue taking Japanese as well?
He's going to take money from everybody. Yeah,
of course. Of course. Why wouldn't he? Sure. So, well, it sounds like he's completely correct in everything that he's saying. Like he's giving accurate predictions and accurate estimates and all of that. So, I mean, how seriously was that taken? Was it just, you know, ultimately kind of lost in the fog, or, you know, did some proactive things happen?
Yeah. U.S. Navy intelligence didn't really have a lot of pull at this point, right? They were just, you know, the naval operations guys. You didn't get promoted in the U.S. Navy back then by doing intelligence, right? And so he wasn't really taken. So they believed what he was saying, although, you know, there's some question of how much you can trust this guy. The FBI was not involved at all until comparatively late. I can tell you how the FBI got involved. It was the people he dealt with thought he was sketchy to start with. He was just a little mysterious. He had a little too much money. Mm-hmm. And at some point, you know, he's dealing with all these British actors. And they, as World War II starts in Europe, they find him alarming. You know, he just came back from Japan. He's got all this extra money. He's talking about his work with Japan. It kind of comes clear to them at some point that this guy just actually might be, you know, it sounds crazy. Just like it sounds crazy to us now that he could be, you know, a Japanese agent. And they go to the FBI. The U.S. Naval Intelligence folks go to the FBI. And the FBI starts looking into this, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the FBI start tailing him and they find some really crazy things that he's doing. They're not finding a smoking gun, but, you know, the biggest thing maybe was the biggest targets for, you know, additional intelligence there were the Lockheed plant and the Douglas plant, you know, most advanced other than Boeing, right? The two most advanced aircraft manufacturers in the U.S. Mm-hmm. He's got an office right across the runway from the Douglas plant. And all of a sudden, Lockheed is hiring a new night janitor. And he and his friends, including Boris Karloff, they know a guy who they think would be a good janitor. He used to work for Boris Karloff. They recommend him to the Lockheed guy who goes to the social club, and the guy gets hired as a night janitor. And kind of in retrospect, right, if you're looking for someone who's going to steal secrets from a U.S. military plant, night janitor is a pretty dang good job, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
He's going around the planet at night and he's everywhere, right? So this fellow was hired, basically Rutland had pushed him pretty hard. So this is your guy, right? And this is just sketchy as all get out, in addition to all the other clues, you know, that are going on, right? Mm-hmm. But this is not a smoking gun. They don't have something to nail him with yet.
Right, right. If I recall correctly, so much of what was really espionage activity, it was wrapped up in kind of his commercial ventures.
So he was doing a lot of it basically completely out in the open, because it was, you know, the kind of normal things that a business partner would need to know or want to know and that sort of thing. And it was really hard to pin, you know, what is espionage activity and what is just, you know, good business practices in a sense, which was very smart on his part.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, getting information from a night janitor who's stealing information, that is espionage. But if you're just meeting people and getting them drunk and getting information on stuff, that's actually hard to pin anything on that on anyone, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So all of this, was he just still basically under investigation when the actual attack on Pearl Harbor occurred, or had things already come to a head by that point?
Things came to a head before that point. It just, the FBI, and they just realized that there's something, you know, they busted a new Japanese spy, a Japanese naval lieutenant who had been pretty brazenly stealing information. Like, here's the air defense around the Boeing plant, shift schedules and where the guns are, right? Here's the locations of every U.S. oil refinery on the West Coast. You know, obviously, if the Japanese attacked those oil refineries, it would have been really bad for U.S., you know, naval activity,
sure.
You know, and then another file locker full of information, right? And in it, this guy is talking with Mr. Rutland. Some of those stories are pretty good, but it's a smoking gun in the FBI's mind, right?
Okay.
So at this point, you know, they're like, what are we going to do, right? We can arrest this guy. We can put him on trial, but that is probably going to be about the most embarrassing thing for the U.S. we could think of, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the U.S. and Britain are rapidly approaching being allies in World War II. But Britain helping the Japanese steal information unopposed for like 7 years, hanging out with Charlie Chaplin and his friends at a party. You know, that's just media dynamite, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So they all get together and they say, look, what are we going to do? We need this guy, you know, out of the picture. They come up with a plan to just get him back to the UK, get him out of sight. MI6 comes in and they promise him, yeah, I should mention that there was some serious fireworks between the FBI and MI6 at this point. Mm-hmm. You never told us about this, but they arranged for him to get, he gets back to England basically on a first class ticket. You know, he pushed really hard, you know, trying to get the Navy to employ him, but the FBI and the State Department were like, this is too risky, right? Mm-hmm. Fairly quickly, you know, they got this list of people to put in jail the moment war erupts with Japan, immediately after Pearl Harbor. You know, he gets that knock on the door from some police officers and they throw him in jail without charges.
Okay. Yeah, this is like the following morning after Pearl Harbor. They're at his home in London, is that right?
Yeah, like they had this list of, if war erupts with Japan, here's your list of people to get.
Gotcha. Right, so he's in jail, I don't know if it, what, detention, would you call it, or prison? I mean, did he go to trial for anything, or was it like a wartime internment kind of situation?
It was wartime internment, and okay. You know, this gets kind of, it gets a little sketchy legally. Mm-hmm. This just, again, it's just too freaking embarrassing, you know, to the crown, right? Mm-hmm. So they keep him in jail without charges. And it was funny, they were thinking about prosecuting him, even if they could avoid it being embarrassing to the crown. The problem was the British had unending proof that he had been spying against the U.S. They didn't have any proof that he had spied against Britain. And they were worried that, like, they put him on trial, they wouldn't be able to get him, convicted. Yeah. So.
Dang. Tricky situation, because it's been mishandled time and time again. It sounds like going back to the early 1920s, essentially, like when they actually knew what was going on with that guy. And, you know, I think it's kind of important to remember here. In my opinion, you tell me if I'm wrong here, Ron, but this attack on Pearl Harbor, most everybody knows about it, of course, and they know how it went down with the, you know, Japanese carriers approached and sent all the fighters and bombers and torpedo planes and everything. But that was essentially a completely new form of attack, right? Because that signaled the end of the battleship era and everything, because now these planes, which, you know, Rutland had an enormous part in developing and practicing and using, they had just negated, you know, the U.S. Navy's biggest strength with all the battleships and everything, and kind of changed the face of warfare. So he really, really is directly responsible for a tremendous amount, or indirectly at least responsible for a tremendous amount of carnage during the war.
Yeah. You know, he had a change of heart, which I believe is real, and he did offer to help out. Yeah. It wasn't accepted. So.
Yeah. His warnings went unheeded.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, with all the agencies fighting each other this way, you know, it comes back, you know, around 9/11, right? Mm-hmm. Very analogous in that the agencies weren't talking to each other.
Oh, yeah.
There were clues here, clues there. Yeah.
Right. Well, so MI6 was, of course, very concerned about, you know, what their guy was doing. But if I recall correctly, didn't J. Edgar Hoover also, he wanted all this, like, you know, buried way, way, way underground because of how image conscious he was for the FBI as well. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly what happened. Oh, man. I found some memos where he's basically telling his folks that, like, you know, even if it's true, do not mention outside the agency that he was working with the U.S. Navy. Because, you know, you think about it, you know, the whole who's blame, you know, whose fault was Pearl Harbor has been a debate in the U.S. for a long time. It's not going to be resolved soon. But, you know, the FBI came off pretty well in that. The blame was taken by the U.S. Navy guys.
Yeah.
Especially the ones, you know, on the scene in Hawaii. And the FBI was not really pilloried for this. If this had gotten out, then they certainly would have got more blame.
Yeah, that's a completely expected institutional reflex at this point. Is like, how do we point the finger at someone else when anything happens that they should have been on top of? And that happens time and time again across all these different organizations. And so much energy is expended in that rather than putting a stop to, or, you know, preempting these attacks and these, you know, acts of espionage and that sort of thing. It's very unfortunate.
Yep, exactly that.
Wow. So how long was Rutland in this internment situation for?
They kept him in as long as they could. You know, there were some British Nazis, head of the British Nazi Party, that they actually let out before him just because it was so freaking embarrassing. You know, a lot of the Royal Navy admirals there were actually trying to get him out. Like, they didn't believe that he deserved to be in prison. Hmm. But MI6, MI5 certainly did. It's funny, people are just fighting everywhere right here. But finally he gets out, you know, not long before the end of the war. Mm-hmm. And he's under strict orders not to do something embarrassing. Just to, you know, okay, we'll let you out, you know, keep your mouth shut, right?
Okay. Is it like a paroled kind of situation, or just we've got our eye on you, you know, unofficially?
Yeah, everything's unofficial.
Okay, I see. Yeah, I see.
It's funny, let him out. You know, there's this kind of, the guy's kids really loved him. You know, it's really obvious from all the correspondence. And his daughter from the U.S. comes out and says, you know, tearfully is telling him, you know, we want you to clear your name. And he's like, I was never charged with a crime.
Yeah, yeah, good point.
How do you clear your name if you haven't been charged, right? Mm-hmm. They let him out, and he continues to respect the U.S. Navy. He loves the Royal Navy, you know, the people that had gone to bat for him and, you know, his old military service. He does not like British intelligence. He thinks he's been railroaded. You know, he finds the names and the addresses of the people the MI5 and MI6 agency dealt with, believe it or not. Apparently he called up and he talked it out of one of the secretaries. You know, the wow. Guy's he's good at what he does, right?
Yeah, he's a bold guy. I have to give him that much.
Bold guy. And he's sending them threatening letters, starts, you know, lawsuits, you know, that kind of thing. Hmm. But he's very bitter. Right. You know, he really wanted to be back in the game. He did not, obviously did not want to be in jail. Mm-hmm. He had actually asked to drive a small boat, you know, the Normandy landings. Mm-hmm. In his mind, he was the perfect small boat pilot. Right.
Wow.
That's what he requested.
In his mind, he was the perfect everything. Usually it's kind of what it sounds like. Well, to me.
That's a fair point. Yeah. Ego knows no bounds. But right. He's like, you know, you need some small boat pilots and I'm your guy. Right. But they never accept that. He's talking with his kids after the war and he's writing up his, you know, very bitter memories of how he's been treated. And at some point, his son finds a suicide note and he's found dead. Mm. Yeah.
Oh, man. That's unfortunate for his kids. Because like you said, I guess he was a pretty good father to them, at least, and they loved him very much.
That's what it, yeah, sure seems to be.
I guess he knew he would carry this around for the rest of his life, no matter what.
Yeah.
Man, what a story for this guy. And it did seem like my reading of it, anyway, the final chapters of the book were that he had a very genuine heartfelt desire to put the uniform back on and fight for Britain, you know, because it was facing this enormous external threat, of course, and he had never been intentionally disloyal to his home country at the very least. So of course I can see why that was a non-starter, like that he was never going to be allowed back in uniform, but it seemed like he was looking for a little bit of redemption there towards the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, redemption, and you know, my reading is he wanted some redemption. He had some conscience, right? Mm-hmm. And you want to be back in the game, you know, he loved the Royal Navy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to ask your opinion again, Ron, when do you think, or was there a particular point that you think that he probably should have been like, okay, this is too far. I'm spying for a foreign power, you know, as opposed to just, you know, providing some, you know, being a consultant essentially to one of our allies. Is there a point that he could have kind of turned this around and negated the, you know, all the effects of what we've been talking about here? Or was he just always in it, you know, for the money and for the opportunities that it all provided?
He definitely was. I believe his change of heart was genuine, but mm-hmm. it just came too late. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, that happened. That's happened many times in the past for a lot of people as well, unfortunately, but he didn't really understand what the ultimate consequences would be. And I have to assume that the family name was, you know, tarnished long after his own passing as well. Do you have any information on that? Like what his kids went on to after that, anything?
His kids actually did really, you know, kind of well in life. And there's all these, you know, Justin, all these puzzles in the story, you know. So his oldest son was a doctor in the Royal Navy fighting against the Japanese. Like, oh, well, why? Okay. That doesn't make sense, right?
Mm-hmm. Like, my gosh.
Against the Japanese. Why wouldn't they put his son somewhere else, right?
Yeah, yeah. No question about it. Man, what a complex story. And like, that's so common for so many of the stories I cover here, is that there are things that are still unknown, unfortunately, and might be for a long time, you know, unanswered questions and things that we can't quite figure out, motivations and that sort of thing. But I've kind of had to learn to accept it, you know, with a lot of these stories that we talk about.
Yeah. Unfortunate, well, isn't it?
It definitely is. It's not good for the terminally curious such as myself.
Yeah, right.
Wow.
You and me both.
Yep, yep. Well, Ron, this is a fantastic book, like I said, and I learned so much from it. I really appreciate you writing it and all the time that went into researching it and getting everything cleared and publishing it as well. So for the listeners out there, I strongly encourage you to read this. You'll learn a heck of a lot about the intelligence picture leading up to American involvement in World War II. So the book title, again, is Beverly Hills Spy, The Double Agent War Hero Who Helped Japan Attack Pearl Harbor, by Ronald Drapkin. Ron, are you working on another book right now, or do you have some other projects in the works now that this has been published?
I am. Yeah, it's definitely going to be about the Japanese Navy.
Oh, okay. Fantastic.
Yeah, it's not quite formed entirely yet, but there's so much out there between Japan and the U.S. that's interesting to me.
Sure, I bet. Is that going to be the same time period? Are you like earlier or later in life or what?
Run up to Pearl Harbor, for sure.
Up to Pearl? Okay, great, great, yeah. I love revisiting that time period, believe me, so that's going to be really interesting. And, you know, we have not covered by any means everything that Ron described in the book, by the way. So there is so much more about the Japanese espionage network inside the United States in Hawaii and the development of the, you know, carrier-based airplanes, the strategy and the technology, everything, and the economic espionage that was going on in the U.S., plus a great look at kind of the golden age of Hollywood, you know, all of those people like Charlie Chaplin, Boris Karloff, others that he mentioned as well. So there's really a lot of breadth and depth to the book, and much more than just Rutland's part in this whole story. So strongly encourage you to pick it up. It's a great read on a couple of different subjects there, and I really enjoyed it. So thank you so much, Ron. I really appreciate your time today. Do you have like a social media profiles or a website, anything like that, that people can look you up on if they want to learn more or connect with you?
Yeah, on Facebook, it's under Beverly Hills Spy.
Okay, mm-hmm. Okay. Easy. Yeah.
Yep.
Fantastic. I see you've done quite a few interviews and that sort of thing as well. So you're really getting this out there, which I'm very glad to see. And I'm glad that I could help as well. So I really appreciate your time, and I look forward to what you write after this.
It's gratifying. Thank you, Justin.
Thank you. Take care.
Yeah. Bye.
If you're interested in more of Spycraft 101, look for my page on Instagram at Spycraft101. You can also find more great articles on my website, spycraft101.com. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll stick around because there's lots more to come.
Disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. The stories and statements expressed herein are experiences and opinions. They may not reflect the views of the host or the production studio. It's okay if you disagree with our content. No piece of media is right for everyone. If you love Spycraft 101, please check us out online, on Instagram, on YouTube, and especially on Patreon. Thank you for listening.